Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening. We're so happy to have you joining us once again on an adventure in history. Well into the month of January. Looking forward to some things coming up in February.
I'm looking forward to getting warmer.
Yeah, it is a little warm. I like the dry, though. The dry and sunny's nice. I'll take that.
Although I will take cold over hot.
Yes, exactly. And we say this as we're like shivering in the basement of the...
Yes.
Of where we record in the drunk tank.
Can you imagine what it must have been like?
Oh, it was miserable.
Although they probably had like a big giant boiler heat.
True. And body heat.
Oil. And, yeah.
And if you are drunk and...
That's
know.
True.
Okay, well. So maybe they had it better.
Maybe they did. So casino night is coming up.
I know. February.
The Roaring 20s, February 15th. It's always during Dark Arts Festival. So the alternative... you can come over to the Heritage Museum and dress in your 1920s costumes. Yeah. $15 a person, $25 a couple. What a bargain.
And a special knock, right? You get to do a special knock on the door to get let in.
And the password is Joe sent me. And you can buy scrip, and it's all fun and games and good activities. And pretty much if you stay the entire 3 hours, you get prizes at the end. And food and beverage, and it's just a good night for the Historical Society. Yeah. A good way to raise some friends and some money.
I mean, this is your annual fundraiser. Like, this is
It's a fundraiser.
Oh, that's fun.
It's really it's a fun thing that we do and we make money at it.
Yeah, and you like it. Everyone likes it, right?
They do. We have costume contests. So.
And that's at what time during the day?
So the gambling starts at 6:30. Doors open at 6.
Okay.
And the gambling goes for 3 hours. There's poker, there's blackjack, craps, roulette. And if you don't know how to play these games, the dealers are professionals and they'll teach you. It's really fun.
Right. No pressure.
And you can always buy more scrip.
That's fun. Earlier that day, you can go to the Special Olympics of Oregon for Clatsop County fundraiser. Mm-hmm. It's a polar plunge.
Brr, sounds cold.
It's their annual fundraiser for the year. Mm-hmm. You can donate. There, it's at Coffinberry Lake at noon. Mm-hmm. Dress to impress, and then go in the water. Or
can you
do
jump
it
in the water fully dressed. Then, if you're dressing
to
impress,
yeah.
Do people do that?
No, I think they all go in swimsuits. Or you do what I do, and you go in your winter clothes and your hat and all that, and you write a check and you make a donation.
Is it guilt money that you're not jumping in the water?
Oh yes, why not? So there are plenty of ways to donate. You can go to Special Olympics Oregon and you can donate online, or you can just show up that day, 12 o'clock, Coffinberry Lake, and they're taking cash or check there too.
Do you get extra points if you go in the water?
You get extra cred.
Okay.
Yes,
and
our number one listener is in the room with us, and she is a Special Olympic athlete, and she is planning on going in the water that day.
She's a swimmer.
Yeah, she's a swimmer. I don't know how much swimming is actually done. I mean, it's going to be freezing.
Yes.
Ooh, sounds miserable.
It does.
It's like anything I can do not to get wet.
That's right.
So, fun.
Maybe it'll be raining that day, too.
Yes.
Just to make it even worse.
There you go.
All right, you got a word for the day?
I got a word. This one's interesting, and I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but I think it's flipe.
Flipe.
It's a verb.
I caught the last flipe to Chicago.
17th century. So, flipe. It's to roll up your socks before putting them on. To fold socks inside out in pairs to fold something back.
Oh.
Yes.
Interesting.
So, in a sentence here, it says he was 40 years old, but his mother still flipped his socks and laid them next to his folded underwear.
Okay, there's a lot going on there.
With that sentence.
Yes, there
I mean, that's
is.
Why this book is so funny, because the example sentences are almost as funny as the words, I would say.
See,
so flipe.
Growing up, I was always a fold the socks. You pair them, and then you fold them. And then once I got married, we tuck them into each other to keep them connected.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. With kids, you've got to tuck them in. I mean... And there's still socks everywhere in my house.
Yes.
Always one.
Well, that's part of the Jerry Seinfeld routine.
Oh.
The socks hate their lives, and they always escape when they're in the dryer.
Yes. As a mom, also, can I just tell people, don't buy my children adorable socks. I will eventually give them away. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer in white socks.
Is this a problem?
It is.
Do people buy your kids socks?
Well, I don't, because there are really cute socks.
Does this
socks
happen a lot?
It does. There's a lot of cute socks out there. And inevitably, they're going to lose one of them, right? So
I remember
white socks.
When Patricia Flavelle, that gave up the Flavelle house, donated the Flavelle house to the county when she was like 21, on her 100th birthday, we were still in contact with her. She lived down in San Francisco. And we took a big picture with all of our volunteers and invited the public with a big banner said, happy birthday and thank you. And took it on the porch, the Flavelle house, the entire house. But we were like, what do we send with this? What do you get a 100-year-old woman?
We
sent her column socks.
Oh, see, there's cute socks out there.
But she wrote the most beautiful handwritten note thanking us.
Oh, that's
100,
nice.
100 years old.
And all I got was a pair of socks.
And a picture.
And a picture.
Of the house I gave up with a bunch of people I didn't know
right.
waving at me, holding a banner saying thank you.
There we go. Okay, well.
All right.
Moving on.
So moving on. So the history highlights. These are things that happen tomorrow, January 27th. Don't have a long list, but 1649, the English High Court of Justice finds King Charles I, and you know I usually don't care about British royalty stuff, but I love this. They find him, King Charles I, quote, guilty of the crimes of which he had been accused, did judge him tyrant, traitor, murderer, and public enemy to the good people of the nation, to be put to death by the severing of his head from his body.
Wow.
I don't know why I like that.
Not leaving anything out in one sentence.
They're very thorough in that sentence.
Yeah.
And it's been a while since I've mentioned beheadings.
Yes, true.
So, it jumped out at me. All right. Just like his head jumped off of his body. 1785, the first U.S. state university is chartered. Guess the state. I probably, out of 13 original colonies, 1785. I probably would have guessed this one maybe 11th or 12th.
Oh, jeez. Massachusetts.
Oh, come on. That would have been my first choice, or Virginia.
Delaware.
Oh, no. Delaware's always first. First state. it was formed in Athens, Georgia.
Oh, yeah. No. Interesting.
Yeah, didn't see that one coming.
No. Okay.
All right. 1880, Thomas Edison patents the electric incandescent lamp.
Okay. Thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah, somebody would have done it. They were already doing it in Germany. 1894. I have a whole thing about Thomas Edison, so don't even get me going.
Not taking credit.
Yeah,
yes.
Don't even get me going. 1894, the first college basketball game. The University of Chicago beats Chicago YMCA. Are you ready for this exciting score?
It's like astronomical, right?
Basketball. I would have thought so, too. 19 to 11.
Oh,
how boring was
That's
that
terrible.
Game have been?
Nobody could make a basket.
Were the games shorter back then or something? 19.
Well,
I had higher scores when I was in like Parks and Rec in
like,
elementary school.
Dude, we just learned the game last week.
1911.
Yeah.
Wow. 19-11. All right. 1945, Auschwitz is liberated. Of course, now that one is liberated by the Soviet Union. But I kind of love Eisenhower, that he forces, when the U.S. starts liberating some of the camps, he forces all of the neighboring citizens to come and look.
Yeah.
I kind of love that he's like, no, you knew this was going on. You're going to look at what you turned your back to.
This was here. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? 1948, the first tape recorder is sold.
Oh, okay.
48.
Yeah. That's later than I would have thought.
Yeah. 1967, astronauts die in launch pad fire. A launch pad fire during Apollo program tests at Cape Canaveral, Florida, kills astronauts Virgil Gus Grissom, Edward H. White II, and Roger Chaffee. An investigation indicated that a faulty electrical wire inside the Apollo 1 command module was the probable cause of the fire. The astronauts, the first Americans to die in a spacecraft, had been participating in a simulation of the Apollo 1 launch scheduled for the next month.
Wow.
Isn't that horrible?
Yeah.
Burst into flames, you can't get out, you're in a suit, you're in a tiny capsule, you're seatbelted in.
But everything that they were trying to accomplish at the time was just so hard, it was, too. I mean, you're doing the first of so many things, and
with a computer that would be dwarfed by our phones.
Oh, for sure.
But our history holiday thing, okay, I think had the most impact. 1888, National Geographic Society is incorporated.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
I think National Geographic had a big impact.
Yep. Yeah, I agree.
Not just Shark Week.
Right.
Which one is there going to be a cow week? Because cows kill more people every year than sharks.
Oh, interesting statistic. Are you sure?
I am positive.
Really?
Yes.
And how did, like, just because, like, farmers?
Over.
Okay.
Yeah, because shark attacks are minimal.
So rare, yeah. Right.
And actually to kill somebody, yeah. Okay. So I think it's something, last time I actually saw this stat, I think it was like 14 to like 4 or something like that.
Interesting.
Actually, vending machines kill even more people.
By falling over.
Falling over because you're banging because your thing didn't fall or whatever, you're mad.
Or kids. I could see kids,
yep,
for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
But they don't get a whole week.
Good useless knowledge that'll keep you going this week.
Well, speaking of useless knowledge.
Uh-huh.
So, went down a rabbit hole. And I came in to think of the things that I was trying to track down.
I know.
It was a very roundabout way. And I stumbled across something that I said, this just cannot be true. And I had to check over and over and over again. And we're definitely going to overstate in the headline, but the facts are still there. This is true.
Okay.
So Pepsi, you know, the company Pepsi, the beverage.
I know it.
Pepsi.
Yep.
Once had the 6th largest navy in the world.
Yeah.
So it needs some explanation.
It does.
We can't just leave it there. And at first, when I saw the headline, I assumed something like, okay, to get their product into Africa or South America, they buy like a bunch of gunboats to deliver it or something. No, this is in the 1980s.
Yeah.
All right. So,
I can't even think of where this would go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Pepsi is, and I was bursting. I was like, oh my gosh, I got to share this one just because it's so amazing. Pepsi is one of the most iconic American brands in the world, and you're bound to start an argument over whether it is Coca-Cola or Pepsi. You know, people.
Right. Are you a Coke fan or a Pepsi fan?
I refuse to say because of the town we're in.
We are in Pepsi country.
The company has a unique history, which involves a Cold War era deal with the Soviet Union and its temporary ownership of the 6th largest navy in the world.
So this became Richard Nixon versus Nikita Khrushchev.
That's how it all starts.
Okay. In the aftermath of the Soviet launch of the Sputnik 1 satellite, the United States was looking to regain its place on the world stage and show that its economical model was better than the communist one presented by the USSR. In 1959, then-President Dwight D. Eisenhower felt the best way to do this was to bring American culture to the Soviets, thereby showing them all the benefits of a capitalist society.
I always thought it was Coca-Cola, blue jeans, and Beatles tapes. It was the way we won the Cold War.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to accomplish this, the U.S. government arranged the American National Exhibition in Moscow's Sokolniki Park. A host of American brands sponsored booths and exhibits, including Pepsi, Disney, IBM, and Dixie Cup. Then,
isn't that funny? Dixie Cup on that list?
Yeah.
Did they not have cups over there?
One, how cool, too. I mean, it's like, you just throw it away.
Throw away
cups.
Yes. I mean, I think that would have been counterproductive with, see how wasteful
capitalism
in America is.
I mean, and dishwashers weren't really popular. Okay. Then Vice President Richard Nixon attended the opening. While there, he and Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev got into a heated debate regarding communism versus capitalism.
These Dixie cups, you just throw them away. How horrible.
And the efficacy of their economic models. Hoping to simmer down any tension, head of Pepsi International, Donald Kendall, offered the latter a Pepsi, which he drank and immensely enjoyed.
Mmm, delicious. How do we get more of this?
So we go down to a deal between Pepsi and the Soviet Union. Years after the exhibition, the Soviet Union wished to make a deal with Pepsi to ensure its products would remain in the country permanently. However, as its money wasn't accepted throughout the world, there was an issue as to how the government would pay for the exchange. That's when the idea came. Vodka.
Under the new deal, the USSR would provide vodka from its state-owned brand, Stolichnaya, I don't know how to say that.
Yeah, Stoli.
Stoli, yeah. That's how I always pronounce it, just Stoli. For resale in the United States in exchange for Pepsi. So Pepsi takes the vodka and gives the Pepsi.
Right, okay.
As a result,
seems like fair trade.
Yeah, as a result, the soda company became the first to secure such an agreement between America and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Stoli experienced immediate popularity upon entering the U.S. market. In 1973, it was selling about 30,000 cases annually in the country, and by 1978 had reached 200,000 annual sales. By 1980, its sales had topped 1 million cases a year, making it the second most popular vodka in America. So, how do we get into the whole Navy thing?
Right.
By the late 1980s, USSR's agreement with Pepsi was due to expire. However, unlike in previous years, their vodka wouldn't be enough to satisfy the American company. This was due to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which led to the boycotting of Soviet products in the United States, including vodka.
Oh.
As such, Swedish vodka brand Absolut quickly surpassed Stoli in popularity.
And remains.
Yeah. The Soviets didn't want to lose Pepsi, so they opted for a rather unorthodox trade with the soda company. In exchange for its product, they would give Pepsi a fleet of warships, including 17 submarines, a frigate, a cruiser, and a destroyer.
Unbelievable. While the country's Cold War budget had resulted in a surplus of equipment for its armed forces, the ships and submarines given to Pepsi were in serious disrepair. Just one of the surface vessels was truly seaworthy, while all the other subs had serious rust issues. The majority also listed to one side. The U.S. government was not happy about the deal Pepsi had made with the USSR and made its feelings known. In response to the uproar, Donald Kendall reminded the Department of Defense he'd managed to reduce the number of naval vessels at the Soviets' disposal, memorably saying, "I'm dismantling the Soviet Union faster than you are."
I kind of love that.
Well, and I was wondering if that's where we were going. Like, oh, is this the United States saying, you know, we want you to do this and then we'll give you the money? But no, yeah. He's just doing it.
Yes, they're just doing it.
Yeah.
So. And technically, I mean, I think these things were not, as it said, seaworthy, but it's still, they are actually submarines, a frigate, a destroyer.
Sure.
That in theory could have been repaired if the Soviets wanted to and wanted to spend the money on it.
Well, somebody did, I'm sure. Eventually, Pepsi sold the ships, here we go, to a Swedish recycling company for scrap, as the company needed to recoup the cost of shipping its product to the Soviet Union. Regardless, for a time, it was the owner of one of the world's largest navies, showing exactly what can happen when a country's citizens really love a product, a particular consumer product.
Isn't that a crack up?
I love it.
So, yeah. You know, I mean, yes, it's a little tongue in cheek, the sixth largest navy in the world at the time. But technically,
it was.
It is true.
Well, and I love that saying. I mean, listen, I'm doing this faster than you are.
Like, yeah.
This is where we talk about government inefficiency, right? Sometimes you just can't get outside of your own head because this is getting outside of the box.
And it's verifiable because we have the stuff. So it's not just like they said, oh, we scrapped it.
Yeah.
Here are the subs we're towing away.
Yeah.
So we know they're not going to be in their fleet
anymore.
They
can't build them.
I just want to know like the discussion that brought this up.
Yeah.
We'll take the Pepsi, but we'll give you, how about submarines?
Yeah.
10. No, make it 20.
Yeah.
17. Deal. I would love to know this back and forth. And did they know the value of the scrap metal already?
Right. I mean, and they're just getting it there, too.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So in the same place that I found this, though, there were a few other amusing things.
Okay.
Just some short ones. So I think the title of this was something like Unknown Stories. And out of the 15 or 20, it's like most of them are known. but there were a few that kind of caught my eye. A student designed the current American flag for a class and got a B- for it. In 1958, Hawaii and Alaska's admittance to the U.S. as states was imminent, so history teachers all over the country asked their students to design a new flag with 50 stars. One student in Ohio, Robert G. Heft, dove into the project with gusto, using his mother's sewing machine, despite having never sewn before, to create a new American flag.
Heft's design was simple, just staggering the stars so there was enough room to add two more. It was so simple, in fact, that he only got the B- on the project for lacking originality. Because of his effort, his teacher joked that Heft's flag was chosen, he'd give him an A. So it did get chosen. A year later, Heft received a phone call straight from President Eisenhower. Out of the 1,500 submissions, Congress had chosen Heft's design. His flag still flies today, and his teacher did, in fact, retroactively give him an A.
Would you believe that phone call?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't. Be like, who is that?
Who's goofing? Who's being silly here?
But the simplicity, I mean, that too, that's probably what they liked about it, because you don't really want to make a big drastic change.
No, I mean, there's symbolism all over the flag, so you don't want to radically change it.
So
the 13 stripes or the 13 original country.
And then it has to be duplicated easily, too.
So, yeah.
Okay.
All right. So the other one that caught my eye, the U.S. had an emperor. And everyone in San Francisco loved him. In 1859, a man named Joshua Abraham Norton sent a proclamation to the San Francisco Bulletin where, quote, at the peremptory request and desire of a large majority of the citizens of these United States, he declared himself Norton the First, Emperor of the United States of America. He then proceeded to list his occupation as emperor in the 1870 census and even created his own currency for use in the imperial government of Norton the First.
On the political side of his reign, Norton fired the governor of Virginia, abolished Congress, and dissolved the Union just before the Civil War. Of course, none of this meant a single thing, and Norton didn't have a hint of legal power. But yet, the San Francisco locals loved him. Police saluted him whenever he passed by, and businesses put up special plaques to let him, the emperor, know they accepted his money, but only from him, and sometimes even offered their services to him for free. Ultimately, Norton perished destitute in 1880, and San Francisco gave him a grand funeral at the time. 30,000 people attended the ceremony of their beloved emperor. Now, that's funny? A sweet story.
So he used to send his proclamations to the paper, and they would publish them?
Right.
And they're very witty, actually. I read through quite a few of them. I didn't print them out for this, but he fires. There's a so-called group calling themselves Congress, and I have not authorized this. And because they're inefficient and they're heading towards war, I banish them immediately, and they must cease and desist and go home. I mean, just things like that. He just is constantly writing these long missives to the paper, and they're publishing them.
Well, and I like, too, that he's Norton the First, but there's no second.
Yes. And some army officers gave him, probably from the Presidio or someplace, gave him a uniform. And he started wearing it, but he kept adding things to it. He had like a helmet with big ostrich feathers sticking out of it. And he kept changing his giant ornate outfit that he'd wear.
I mean, I sort of picture maybe a homeless man, but obviously very gregarious, full of personality. I mean, obviously. And then San Francisco, too, at the time felt so disenfranchised from the rest of the country that some of this stuff, albeit, you know, tongue in cheek, they probably were like, you know, like
we could secede from the Union.
Right. I mean, we aren't always well represented. So fun.
That's the whole reason that the Pony Express was so important.
Right.
Communication. We're out there on the other coast and we don't know what's going on back east. And we want mail. We want information. And you got to speed it up.
Yeah.
And that's why the telegram finally, when it got there. All right. Now we know what's going on.
Yeah. Immediately. Okay.
All right. So we do have some local history this week in local history. Shall we?
Yeah, just looking back on it. So January 26, 1925. I love this. Balmy day sends many to bask at the seashore. Beach parties in midwinter were a reality at Seaside. There hasn't been such a busy Sunday at the popular resort city since the close of last season. A continuous line of motor traffic plied between Astoria and Seaside yesterday, and there were hundreds of visitors from the city and over the county to the beach metropolis. The sun shone warmly, and there was a total absence of wind. The sea was as smooth as glass, and the air as mild as temperance beverage. People strolled up and down the promenade or on the beach. Kids dug in the sand or skipped rope with long strands of kelp. Clamming parties were in evidence in the late afternoon, and some few parties even spread robes on the sand and basked in the warm sunshine.
All right. You will never, ever, ever catch me skipping rope with long strands of kelp.
Or spreading your robe in the sands.
Well, maybe.
I love it. I mean,
the kelp, no, not going to happen.
It's just like this person's like, you know, if I'm going to work today, I'm going to work on the beach with my beach towel, and then I'll write to an article. Yeah. And then this is the article that comes.
All right. So I know this one is sort of modern, but it still makes me laugh because 100 years from now, maybe somebody will be reading it on whatever transmittal devices there are in the future. January 26, 2018.
Okay.
Public safety calls, suspicious circumstances / disturbances. Elk fighting with dogs. A 4-point bull elk was inside a fenced yard sparring with the dogs and the fence. Fish and game officers were called. Eventually, the elk got in a dispute with another elk and ran off.
That is a funny one.
It's over in Warrington.
They're going to be like, oh, it was. Of course it was. I'm like, there was so many elk every day. Don't get me started. Yep. January 27th, 1882. This morning, the inhabitants of this quiet little town of Oysterville were awakened by the hideous howling of a whistling buoy, which has been washed from its proper place of residence, supposed to be from the near the mouth of the Columbia River, and seated its noble self in the ocean opposite here and about 2 miles offshore. To say that they were wonderstruck is only a mild way of expressing it. None could solve the mystery. Each seemed to have a different opinion of its origin or whereabouts. One man, for instance, arose, jumped into his clothes, and rushed around the corner to see if it was someone in distress. After following the noise from house to house, he returned home, none the wiser for his search. Some thought it was Native Americans lamenting their dead. Another took up his good old cow horn, starting off over the hills and far away, stopping at intervals to blow and holler, thinking to find someone in great distress. It's just a whistling buoy.
Just a whistling buoy. So January 30th, 1886, this is kind of the opposite of that one hanging out at seaside in the sun. To find a dry spot yesterday was like looking for shadow in a fog. Everything was wet, sodden, and dampish. The rain melted the snow, and the snow held the rain in round pools of slush, through which men and horses squashed and splashed. School children left their shoes and waded, crying back to get them out. Roofs leaked. Half-melted snow slid with a heavy slump and choked the eaves, which overflowed. Rain everywhere, and one individual who, as he sprawled in the street, exclaimed, "Darn such weather!" expressed the exact sentiments of nearly everyone who had to be out yesterday.
So from one balmy day back to a rainy day.
But I still, I mean, these people are poets.
Yes, they are. I mean, the writing is so great. Okay, I'm going to skip to February 1st, 1932. Prices on haircuts take slide. Local men rush barbers. Long-haired Astorians today were rushing to the barber shops. The reason for the invasion is the fact that haircuts today went down in price. People who have let their hair grow long until it looked like a Brazilian jungle can now get it trimmed for 50 cents as a result of recent action of the Master Barbers of Astoria, which went into effect today.
I love that there was an organization.
Yes.
The Master Barbers of Astoria.
And they agreed to lowering their prices.
They're setting the prices. And maybe people thought it was too high. So
we have
this meeting and we figure out, okay, what are we going to do? Nobody's getting their hair cut. Well, let's lower the prices.
50 cents.
Let's all agree.
Okay.
All right. So casino night on the 15th. Just check our website, AstoriaMuseums.org, and the Polar Plunge earlier in the day.
Yeah. Sounds fun.
So where do we find information on that?
On Special Oregon or Special Olympics Oregon, yes, .org.
All right. There we go. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening. Go make some history.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.